Hi, everybody. I hope you are enjoying the rain. You know, I think I mentioned before that the Sfas Emes tells us that the very definition of a Yehudi is one who is grateful, right? Leah called her fourth son Yehuda because she said, "Now I am grateful. I have gotten more than I deserve." But she knew she's entitled to three, and she has four, more than I deserve. It's not Magiali. So Rabbi Miller used to always talk about the idea, based on the Sfas Emes and the Chovas HaLevavos much earlier, that the very definition of a Jew is one who goes through life with the idea that Hashem has given me more than I deserve. So the specific examples he used to give were, how do you respond to weather? He says, it's a very important thing. You know, often we complain about the weather. Mark Twain's famous statements, everybody complains about the weather, nobody does anything about it. And the concept is, you know, when it's raining, it's raining. When it's hot, it's hot. When it's cold, it's cold. You could do exactly the opposite. Wow, it's raining. Wow, the sun is great. The cold air is so, you know, so energizing and the like. So he said that this is a message that even young children get at a very young age, that they view everything that happens in life as potentially something beautiful, something good. And he says this is mashrish in our children, midos of hakaras hatov. So Baruch Hashem in Eretz Yisrael, I think, because we understand that rain is such a bracha, because we don't get rain that often, only a certain amount of the year, and a lot of that time has already expired without rain, there's a special reason to rejoice. And in fact, if you learn the Gemaras and Maseches Tainis that talk about rain, the Gemara goes on and on and on in just very lyrical, joyous prose. You really have a sense of how Chazal looked at rain as such a bracha. And that's how we should look at it as well. So, enjoy the rain. Now, what I wanted to share with you is, you know, this Friday is Asara B'Teves. It is the only one of our Tanesim that can fall on Friday. And we fast on Friday. It's a quite unusual scenario. But the Avudraham, one of the great Rishonim, actually writes that if it would be possible according to the Jewish calendar, and it's not possible, that Asara B'Teves would be on Shabbos, you would even fast on Shabbos. And the reason is, textually, unlike the other fast days that are described only in terms of the month, like Av is called the fast of the fifth month, Tammuz is the fast of the fourth month, Tzom Gedalia is the fast of the seventh month, counting from Nisan. And because the fast is defined in terms of the month rather than the day, it is shayach, the concept of nidcheh, that if Shabbos affects the actual day, we push it off. As opposed to Asara B'Teves, which was really the first in the sequence. This was the day that Nebuchadnezzar began the siege against Jerusalem, culminating in the Churban 3 years later. The language of the Pasuk is, Be etzem hayom hazeh. On this very day, Samach Melech Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, began his siege against Jerusalem. And the Avudraham is medayek, that because of the words, Be etzem hayom hazeh, the fast is not based on the month, in which case you could move the day around if there is a Shabbos, but rather would even be Docha Shabbos. Now it happens to be that in our calendar, Asara B'Teves can actually not fall on Shabbos, so you're not going to test the Avudram's Chiddush, so to speak. But this is the Avudram's Chiddush LaHalacha, and we do see that we fast on Friday. There's normally a halacha generally that we try not to fast on Friday because we don't want to enter Shabbos in a state of being uncomfortable, and yet for this fast we actually do. Another bit of trivia, which somebody pointed out to me around 15 years ago, that because of Jewish leap years and the like, it is actually possible to have a whole year where a whole secular year where there is no fast of Asara B'Teves, because 1 year Asara B'Teves might be in, it might be maybe the end of November, and another year it might be the beginning of January, so you can actually skip Asara B'Teves in a calendar year, which is actually very, very interesting in that way. I think Rebbetzin Bullman actually told me that around 15 years ago, but okay. But when we think about fast days,
and we think about the Churban Beis HaMikdash, this is true for all fast days. We are not simply mourning the past, but we're trying to contemplate what caused the Churban, and what can I do in my own life to rectify the Churban. And here we have some very, very interesting lessons from the Parshios in the Torah, of course. You know, we read, these are the weeks that we read about Yosef getting reunited with Yaakov. And there's a famous Chazal that at the very moment that Yaakov and Yosef were reunited, imagine being separated for 22 years. And throughout that time, Yaakov actually thought that Yosef was dead. And now he discovers that Yosef is alive. In fact, the news had to be broken to him very gradually, Serech Bas Osher, etc. It would have killed him out of excitement. And imagine the moment of that reunion. How much love, how much joy, how much nachas. So Chazal say, what did Yaakov do at precisely that moment? Yaakov read Kriya Shema. Yaakov recited Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Why did he recite Kriya Shema at that moment? So the Maharal writes in the Gor Aryeh, an important yesod, that it is the Derech HaTzadikim, it is the way of righteous and holy people, that when they feel profound emotions of joy and love, they want to direct it and channel it into the service of Hashem and not use it for their parochial self-interest. So when Yaakov feels love and Yaakov feels simcha, he says, let me use it to praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu and not simply keep it as my private joy. They tell a similar story, somewhat similar, with the Chafetz Chaim much later, that when the Chafetz Chaim lost one of his sons, who was a great Talmud Chacham, and the son died, so the Chafetz Chaim said at the Levaya the following words. Again, this may strike us as a bit strange, but this is what he said. He said that all of my life I wanted to fulfill the verse of Yahavta Es Hashem Elokecha B'chol Levavcha, of loving Hashem with all my heart. But I couldn't love Hashem with all my heart, because part of the love of my heart was towards my son, towards my child. So I couldn't give Hashem my whole heart. So now the Chafetz Chaim says, the love that I can no longer express towards my child, I hereby give to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I want to take that love and give it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Just like Rabbi Akiva said, all of his life he wanted to fulfill the pasuk, V'yahavta Es Hashem Elokecha b'chol nafshecha, with all of your soul, even to give your life. And Rabbi Akiva was not able to fulfill that until he was tortured to death. And he said, I am happy now because I can now give my life to Hashem. The Chafetz Chaim said the same thing, b'chol levavcha. And this is the idea of Yaakov being korei Kriya Shema. And this is something that we can apply. I mean, obviously we're on a much, much lower madrega. But when a person has a great joy in life, whatever it would be, the birth of a child, the birth of a grandchild, a chasana, even things that are not of the same magnitude, but you got a good job or your article got accepted for publication, a person feels a certain happiness, a certain joy. So turn it to Hashem and say, Hashem, I am so grateful for the joy that you gave me, and turn it as an expression of Avas Hashem. So this is a well-known Chazal, and I think the Maharal's explanation is also fairly well-known, but I want to share with you a passage in the Zohar that's a little less known. The Zohar HaKadosh actually says that there's a foreshadowing in Hashem's words to Yaakov that Yaakov will or Yaakov should read Kriya Shema. Because when Yaakov hears the news in Eretz Yisrael that Od Yosef Chai, that Yosef is alive, and therefore he has to go to Mitzrayim, you'll recall that Yaakov is very afraid of going to Mitzrayim. Yaakov has a tremendous fear in Pachad. Why is that so? Because Yaakov knows that this is the beginning of the difficult exile that was foretold to Avraham Avinu. And Yaakov knows it'll be physically crushing. Yaakov knows it'll be spiritually devastating, and perhaps we're going to reach the 50th level of Tuma and be irredeemable, because we were indeed very close to that. So Hashem appears to Yaakov v'maros halayla in the night visions, because night is also a symbol of galus and hester punim. And he says, Al tira, do not be afraid, for I will bring you to Mitzrayim, but I will also take your children out. You will survive, your nation will survive. They will not be destroyed.
And HaKadosh Baruch Hu then uses a phrase, Yosef yashis yado al einecha. And Yosef will put his hand on your eyes.
Now that's an odd expression even in terms of pshat. You know, when you're united with your child, you hug, you embrace. You don't necessarily put, you know, a hand over the eyes. The Zohar HaKadosh says
that is a remez to the recitation of Shema, because when you recite Shema, you put your hands over your eyes. And therefore, by HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling Yaakov,
Yosef shall put his hand over your eyes, that is a remez that Yaakov is to read the Shema. But of course, the question still becomes, well, when I read Shema, I put my hand over my eyes. You don't put, you know, your hand over my eyes. And what is Yosef putting his hands over Yaakov's eyes? Why is that the connection to Kriya Shema? So one of the explanations that's offered is the following. Shema, again, we're not allowed to rate Pesukim. One can't say what's the most important Pesuk in the Torah. We're not allowed to say that. But still, Shema Yisrael certainly expresses an idea that is the very foundation of what it means to be a Jew, to believe in the unity of God, the supremacy of Hashem, that He is my King, that He is the Creator of heaven and earth. There is only one, there is no duality. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is unique. But the Kli Yakor offers an additional nuance in this. And that is, often we tend to perceive at least a duality in God, as if, chas v'shalom, there are two gods. We have the God of mercy and compassion and kindness and chesed. And then we sometimes have the God that is stern and punishing and rejecting. Or the God who is absent, who is not even involved at all. The God that is indifferent. In fact, there's an interesting book, and I'm not necessarily saying it's a kosher book, but a fellow, Jack Miles, wrote God, the Biography. And he actually goes, again, I guess maybe I don't want to recommend it directly, but somebody sent it to me in the mail, so I did have it, Eschataya Nimaske. And basically, he goes through the different books of the Bible. You know, this book of Tanakh, you know, God sleeping, God indifferent, God merciful, God punishing. As if to say, there are different nuances in how HaKadosh Baruch Hu relates to the Bria at different times. So Chas V'Shalom, a person might say, just as Zoroastrianism says, there is a God of light and the God of darkness. That's why in Tefillah, Chazal were so makbid in the brachos of Kriya Shema, that you have to mention night during the day, Yotzer Or Uborei Choshech, and you have to mention day during the night, as if to say that there, and this is specifically directed in Persia against Zoroastrianism and the like, that there is no separate, God forbid, God of light and God of darkness. There is no God of good and God of evil. There is only one God who does everything and decides everything for whatever his reasons are. But we perceive dichotomy. We perceive contradiction. We perceive inconsistency. But in reality, this is reflected in the two different names of Hashem. Yudke Vavke is the Midah of Rachamim. Elohim is the Midah of Din. So here's what the Kli Yakor says. It's a very nice additional insight into Shema Yisrael. Shema Yisrael, hear meaning understand, internalize. Hashem Elokeinu, we who perceive Hashem as the God of mercy. And we also perceive Elokeinu Elokim, we perceive the God of mercy. And the God of punishment? Hashem Echad. It is all Hashem, Yudke Vavke. It is all the God of mercy. Meaning to say, in ways we don't always understand, even the Onshim, even the Midas Hadin, even the suffering that HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows to happen, is ultimately an expression of a higher mercy, of a higher rachamim. In fact, it's very interesting, the hierarchy here, because when you talk about Hashem and Elokim, they seem to be two equal names. Hashem is rachamim, Elohim is din. And yet we know in the hierarchy of Hashem's names, Yudkei Vavkei is a higher madrega, because that's the name we don't even pronounce. So essentially what it's telling you is, in manifestation, we have Rachamim manifestation and Din manifestation, but it all emanates from a higher level of Rachamim. In other words, even the Din is an expression of Hashem's Rachamim. And therefore, that's what the Pasuk says, Shema Yisrael, you see Hashem, the God of mercy, and you see Elokeinu, the God of justice, retribution, punishment, rejection, Hester Panim, Hashem Echad, it is ultimately one indivisible unity of Rachamim. A Rachamim that we may not be able to perceive in our lifetime. They tell a story, some people don't like this story at all, but I'll just mention the story, that the Magid of Mezirich, the Mezirich Magid, the Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov, lived at a time when life was extremely difficult for the Jews in Russia. And when he was on his deathbed, his Talmidim asked him, when you go up to Shemayim, please pray, be a Melitz Yosher, pray to the Ribbono Shel Olam that the Gezeros rise on Klal Yisrael should become Bata. You have such Zechus. And the Magid of Mezirich promised his Talmidim that he would go to the Kisei HaKavod and be Mavakesh Rachamim. And he died. He was Nifter. And nothing got better. Things got worse. So the Talmidim wondered, why isn't the Rebbe praying for us? So the Rebbe appeared to them in a dream. And they asked the Rebbe, you know, why aren't you doing your job up in Shemayim? So the Rebbe said, you know, you're 100% correct. I was Makabel, that I would be Mispalel, that all that is bad should be changed. But from my perspective, I don't see anything bad that's happening. Meaning to say, I don't know what to pray for anymore. Again, some people don't like this story because L'maisa, we are supposed to pray if there's suffering and the like. But the point is that indeed, in deep levels that we don't always understand, and sometimes we do understand, what looks like the expression of the greatest din and onesh is in fact rachamim. Now, the Kli Yakar says this on the pasuk Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, but in truth it is actually a Gemara in Brachos, which it says this in connection with a different pasuk. This is a well-known pasuk in Zechariah that we say in Aleinu two or three times a day. V'nemar v'haya Hashem l'melech al kol haaretz, that may Hashem be the king over all of the world. Bayom ahu, on that day of redemption, Mashiach, Yia Hashem Echad, God will be one, Ushamo Echad, and His name will be one. The Gemara asks Akasha, what do you mean God will be one? Is not God one now? Of course God is one. So the Gemara in Bracho says, no, Olam Hazeh is not like Olam Haba. In Olam Hazeh, for good news, we make the bracha of Hatov v'Hameitev, or Shechianu. For bad news, tragedies, Dayan HaEmes. We see good and we see bad. So it looks, in terms of manifestation, as if there are two gods. Liyasid Lavai, we will only see one name of God, the name of Rachamim. And then God will be united, because even on what looked bad, we're going to make Hatov v'Hameitiv in retrospect. So the same point the Gemara makes with B'yomahu Yeh Hashem Echad U'Shmo Echad, the Kli Yakar takes it into Shema Yisrael itself. So based on all of this, this could be the explanation of why we cover our eyes when we say Shema. Why do we cover our eyes? Why do we put our hand over our eyes? Some say it's just to concentrate, to focus, not to be distracted. But another explanation might be that essentially what we're saying is we're blind. We don't see the true inner reality and dynamic of Hashgacha in the world. We see things as bad, as destroying us, as pushing us away. When in point of fact, every Nisayon is an opportunity for transformation and for growth and for closeness to Hashem and for resilience and for the development of character in many, many different ways. And ultimately, in ways we don't always perceive, it is a chesed of Hashem on some level. So what we're basically saying is,
We are affirming that in a world of dichotomy, there is ultimate unity. And if I see dichotomy, it is because I don't see. I am blind. Right? So covering the eyes is that sense of being blind and not understanding. Now, based on this, let's look at the story of Yaakov. For 22 years, Yaakov lived in a state of utter perplexity, of utter confusion, of utter sadness. Remember, for 22 years, he didn't have Ruach HaKodesh. For 22 years, that's a little complicated, actually, a little contradictory. The Pashtus is that, right, the brothers told Yaakov that Yosef was dead, that Yosef was killed by a wild animal, and that's why his Kesones Pasim has blood on it, etc. It's either Yosef's blood or the blood of the animal in the fight, etc. But you know, Rashi says a strange thing. The Pasuk says that Yaakov was not comforted. Now, why wasn't Yaakov comforted? So Rashi brings the Chazal, Ein Mekablin Tanchumin Al Hachai. What does that mean? Hashem created in the nature of the world that we get a certain comfort with the passage of time. Time generally heals the intensity of suffering. Because otherwise, God forbid, somebody suffers a bereavement, they could never recover. So Hashem made it in the Teva that we eventually come back to life. But that Gezerah was made only on someone who dies. But since Yosef didn't die, Yaakov could not be comforted. Now, my question is, it's an obvious question, so, if Yaakov sees he's not comforted, it's almost a catch-22, then he should automatically assume that Yosef is alive and then feel better. Although maybe he wouldn't feel better. He didn't learn Rashi. Yeah, so that's a question a little bit. But by the way, the Chassam Sefer says, and this is apropos of Asar B'Teves, this wasn't part of my career, but it reminds me, you know, there's a famous Chazal that says, Kol HaMisabel Al Yerushalayim, if you mourn over Jerusalem, the Chorban, Zoche, you merit, Veroa, and you see, Besimchasa. Right? So the simple meaning of the Gemara is, if I mourn not having a Beis HaMikdash, if I mourn the Golus of Klal Yisrael, the Golus of the Shekhinah, Hashem will give me the Zechus of experiencing redemption. But the Chassam Sefer asks that it is not written in the future tense, it is written in the present tense. Really, it should say, Kol HaMisabel Al Yerushalayim, Yiskeh V'Yireh. You will merit, you will see the Simcha. Zoche means you see it right now. You see it right now. How is that? How do I experience it right now? So the Chassam Sefer says the following. The emes is the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed almost 2,000 years ago. Why haven't we gotten over it yet? After all, time is supposed to heal all the wounds. The reason is because Ein Mekablin Tanchumin Al Hachai. When someone is alive, you don't get comforted. You only get comfort if something was dead. So Memela the following. Paradoxically, if I would no longer mourn over the temple, that would mean I've accepted the Beis HaMikdash as dead. And that's why it doesn't affect me. Eventually I go on with my life. But if I'm Misabel Al Yerushalayim after 2,000 years, I still feel pain. That means it's alive to me. So, paradoxically, the very fact that I feel pain means I'm experiencing redemption right now. In other words, it's almost like a positive message. Why do I feel pain? Because it's still alive, it's still here, it can still come down, it still will come down, Min HaShemayim. So the Chassam Sefer says, the depth to which you're misabel is how much it is still a reality to you. It is not something in the past that you simply get over, and therefore you are experiencing redemption right now. So, with Yosef, for those 22 years, Yaakov Avinu saw no pattern in this. What's the purpose? Rachel was his, the wife that he loved the most. Yosef was her son. She died in childbirth with Binyamin. And all of a sudden, Keheref Ayin, Yaakov now understands everything. Why Yosef had to go to Mitzrayim, how Yosef prepared the ground
for the Jewish people to be able to survive Mitzrayim, because Yosef taught us how to survive in Golus at the nadir of lowliness and slavery and imprisonment, and at the height of godless and power and influence. And Yosef modeled in his life how we survive those temptations. Yosef is not only the one that economically is able to sustain his family, but spiritually give us the hachana to survive in Golus. So what looked like a senseless rejection by HaKadosh Baruch Hu all of a sudden has meaning and purpose, in which we now see how Hashem orchestrated even the averos of the brothers. We're not whitewashing the brothers here. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, again, Hashkacha is a very complicated job. There's a pasuk in Eiv, right, when Eiv was complaining about different things. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Eiv, if you could do a better job, I'll give you the job. You want to take over for a day? See what you'll do. Right? Not at all easy. Because the problem basically is everything that happens to a person is decreed by God, but human beings have total free will. So, how do you match that? Meaning to say, the brothers were not forced to sell Yosef. The brothers did an Avera. The brothers exercised their Bechira. And yet, this had to happen to Yosef. Because if it wasn't Hashem's will that it had to happen, it wouldn't have happened. So what would have happened if the brothers would have exercised their Bechira and not sold Yosef? Our assumption has to be that Yosef would have been kidnapped by some mafia gang and whatever it is. It's an extremely complicated idea where our Kadosh Baruch Hu has a predetermined plan for the world in which he has to match up the trillions of decisions that billions of people make every minute in terms of what will advance HaKadosh Baruch. Think about, you ever see a picture of the air traffic controllers? They got to balance all of these different flights and coordinate all of these things. Well, multiply it by factors of billions and billions and billions. And this is what HaKadosh Baruch has to do, you know, every second. Because the concept is, see, if you lived in a world without Bechira, God's job would be a lot easier, because essentially God would just be moving pieces on a chessboard, and he would be controlling both sides of the board, so he moves wherever he wants the pieces to go. But here you have a situation where kavyachol, God is only controlling one side of the board. The other side of the board, there's complete freedom of movement, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to, just like a chess grandmaster, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to determine the outcome in response to every single move, but yet HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a predetermined plan that he has. So, the meaning that Yosef will put his hands on your eyes. So I asked, why is that the remez to Kriyat Shema? Because putting your hands on your eyes shows us how blind we are to the true nature of reality. Hashem is telling Yaakov, it is Yosef that will show you your blindness. You thought for 22 years that this was a senseless tragedy. You will now understand that you were blind for those 22 years. You didn't truly see what was going on. Right? And that's the connection to Kriyat Shema, and that's why Yaakov read Kriyat Shema, in addition to the Maharal's explanation that tzaddikim take their love and give it to Hashem. We have this idea that Yaakov was zeicha to understand how everything fits. But to take this a little further, you know, when they tell Yaakov, Od Yosef Chai, Yosef is still alive, V'chi hu ha-moshel b'chol Eretz Mitzrayim, and he is the ruler of all Eretz Mitzrayim. So what does the pasuk say? Why hem in lahem? Yaakov did not believe it. The Chafetz Chaim has a well-known word. The Chafetz Chaim says, what is it that Yaakov didn't believe? So here's the point. There are two statements being made here. Statement number one is, Yosef is still alive. Meaning Yosef, who is a tzaddik, who is righteous, who is pure. He's still Yosef. He's not Sofnas Paneach. He's Yosef. And he is the highest ruler in Egypt, only secondary, second only to Paro. So the Chafetz Chaim says Yaakov could not believe that both of those statements are true. If you told me he's Yosef and he's sitting in Kolel, I'll believe that. If you tell me he's a Moshe b'chol Eretz Mitzrayim, but he no longer believes in God, I'll believe that. What I can't believe is, how could he still be Yosef and be a Moshe b'chol Eretz Mitzrayim? That's impossible. Because power corrupts, and to be a Mishnah l'melech in a corrupt, decadent, immoral society. And indeed, the Ramban remarks that in some ways Mitzrayim was worse than Sodom. Actually, it's a famous Ramban. The Ramban says in Parshas Vayera, why was Sodom destroyed? Because it was such an evil place. Mitzrayim was worse. The Ramban says Mitzrayim was worse than Sodom. The Ramban says the difference is Sodom was in Eretz Yisrael. And therefore Hashem does not tolerate evil in Eretz Yisrael. Chutz La'aretz will tolerate it a little more. Right, that's what the Ramban says. That's why the Torah is Vagili Arayos in Parshas Acharei Mos. V'lo soki ha'aretz eschem, which literally means, it's very strong language, that when you're nichshal in Gili Arayos, the land will vomit you out. It's like the land gets sick and vomits. Okay, now I'll leave it to your own thought about the implications of that in our own life and society. But I'm just quoting a pasuk in the Torah. That when, if Klal Yisrael is nichshal bi'arayas, below saki ha'aretz eschem, the land will vomit you out. In the Ramban's formulation, eina seiveles ovrei aveira, it does not have patience, so to speak, for ovrei aveira. Okay. That's why the famous idea that a chait that is done in Eretz Yisrael is a bigger aveira than the same chait done in Chutz La'aretz, because you are in the palace of the king. In fact, that was even used by some poskim in the 19th century to potter people from coming to Eretz Yisrael. There actually was a cheshbon. Some Hasidic rebbes actually told their followers that maybe it's better for you not to come to Eretz Yisrael, because if you're going to do Averis, you know, do it in Chutz La'aretz. Okay. Of course, again, I mean, halachically we don't follow that, but there was such a shita that way. So this is what, alright, but be it as it may, Egypt was such a corrupt culture. Yaakov couldn't believe, how could Yosef be a tzaddik and still be so high in Mitzrayim society? So what convinced Yaakov that the statement was true? So the pasuk goes on and says he saw the agalos, the wagons, and that convinced him. Vatechi ruach Yaakov avim. Yaakov was revived. What's the wagons? So we have two pshatim. Rashi gives one explanation and the Medrash gives another. Actually, the Medrash gives two explanations, but Rashi only quotes one. The first explanation which Rashi brings is that agalos is a pun on the word egla. Agala is a wagon and egla is a calf. So it's the same letters, same consonants. And it is brought down that the last piece of Torah learning that Yaakov was learning with Yosef before they were separated, when Yosef was 17, was the Parsha of Egla Arufa. Right? What is the Parsha of Egla Arufa? That when you find a corpse outside of a city, and we don't know who murdered this person, so we measure to the closest city, to the corpse, Machlokas, if you measure from the head or from the feet, let's say it's between two cities, but whatever, let's assume it's the closest city, and the elder of the city bring a calf, and they decapitate the calf, and they recite a prayer for forgiveness, may Hashem forgive us, and we'll discuss what are they being forgiven. For reasons I'll discuss in a few moments, this was the last inyan that Yaakov learned with Yosef. So by Yosef sending agalos, which sounds like egla, Yaakov realized that Yosef was still committed. It was like a secret message, still committed to that Torah. And therefore he was okay. But there's another medrash, or a davar acher in the medrash, that says that agalot literally means wagons, not egla. And it refers to the idea that the Mishkan was carried in the desert. Right, the Aron HaKodesh was carried on the shoulders of the Levim. But the heavy boards were carried in wagons. Right, wagons. And therefore, this is a remez to the Agalos HaMishkan, and this gave Yaakov Nachas that this is yet a reassurance that his children will leave Mitzrayim and build a Mishkan, and there'll be Hashras HaShchina. So in effect, we have two pshatim. Is the Agalos a remez to Egla Arufa, or is the Agalos a remez to the Agalos which carried the Mishkan? But now I want to go back and say that in effect, both these pshatim are addressing Yaakov's concern. Because what is, again, according to the Chafetz Chaim, what is bothering Yaakov? It's not that he's mesupik whether Yosef is dead. He believes Yosef is alive. Sarach Basasher told him this. He knows Yosef is alive now. But he says, how could my son be a tzaddik, living in a corrupt, decadent, evil culture? And he's not a person who's avoiding that culture, like going into Kollel or moving into the, whatever, the Me'asharim of Mitzrayim, whatever that would be. He's a person who's involved in that life. How could he not be corrupted? So I want to suggest that the two meanings of Agalos are precisely an answer to that question. In other words, the two pshatim are answering Yaakov's question, how does a Jew survive in Golos when they are actively involved in that society? Let's first take the Agolos of the Mishkan. The Mishkan, of course, was the equivalent of the Beis HaMikdash in the desert. But there's one fundamental difference between the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash is a single stationary location, the Har HaBayis, Yerushalayim. The Mishkan, first of all, it was located in Chutz Laaretz, obviously, but moreover, it moved from place to place. So the Mishkan represents what we might term the portability of Kedusha. Now, this is a bit of a difficult idea, because on one hand, it is absolutely clear that the Torah is makir, the concept that some places are holier than other places. I mean, Kedushas HaMakom is an important idea. Eretz Yisrael is holier than any other nation, any other country. Yerushalayim, holier, right? The Beis HaMikdash, even within the Beis HaMikdash, you have the Har HaBayis, and you have parts of the Beis HaMikdash culminating in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, etc. So on one hand, Judaism does say that some places are holier than other places. And by the way, that needs to be addressed too, because in truth, you cannot say that God is intrinsically more in Yerushalayim than he is in Arkansas. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is everywhere all the time. Malei kol haaretz kavod. So God is not here more than he is there. Okay, it would actually be blasphemy to say God is here and God is not there. So when we talk about a makom being more kadosh than another makom, we are not referring to the presence or absence of God intrinsically. We are referring to the ability of my neshama to be open and interconnect with Hashem. So an example might be, take a cell phone, right? There are places where there's better reception, a radio or a cell phone, and worse reception, right? So kedushas hamakom means the potential receptivity of one's connection to Hashem is enhanced in certain places, but it doesn't really refer to Hashem being limited in one place or another. So on one hand, does Judaism believe that some places are holier than others? Of course. But there is a certain downside and a mistake that we can make when you emphasize the Kedusha of Makom. And that is, sometimes a person is not in that makom. Sometimes a person has to be in Chutz Laaretz. Or in a more general sense, sometimes a person's external environment is not optimally conducive to his avodas Hashem. Family pressures, parnasa pressures, difficulties in marriage. A person is not in the right yeshiva or no yeshiva at all. And if you tend to focus on this ideal setting as the way you will serve Hashem, then when you're not in that ideal setting, you kind of put your life on hold. And that's a very subtle mistake that people make all the time. It's always, if only I had a different family, a different husband, a different wife, different kids, different parents, different yeshiva. Then I could serve Hashem properly. But Nebuch, I don't have any of that. I'm stuck. Now, certainly common sense and ishtadlus tell us that if I'm in a bad situation and I'm able to change it, I'm obligated to change it. Right? That's obvious. I don't simply say, wherever I am is where I have to be. But the corollary of that, the converse of that is, that when you are in a situation that you cannot change, whether it's permanent or even temporary, then you have to assume you have the potential for holiness wherever you are, within your family, within your marriage, within your framework, within your yeshiva. And the Chafetz Chaim used to say that that was the message to Moshe Rabbeinu when he is standing in front of the burning bush. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, take off your shoes because the place where you are standing is holy ground. The Chafetz Chaim says, what place is that? And the Chafetz Chaim says, Hashem is speaking to everybody. The place where you are is Kadosh. Don't think you have to be somewhere else. Either, or, you know, again, it's a complicated idea because on one hand we are Mater Kedusha Sakam. But the Mishkan teaches us, the concept of portability of Kedusha. And this is answer number one to Yaakov. If Yaakov is asking, how does a Jew survive in a hostile Golos? The answer is by internalizing the idea of Mishkan, that the Shekhinah is with me wherever I am, wherever my situation. See, this is the downside of nostalgia. Nostalgia is a wonderful thing. It gives us chizuk and connection to the past. But we have to recognize where we are is where we can grow as well. You can't live in that imaginary. In fact, some want to say, this is why Yosef named his first child Menashe. Menashe is Nashani Elohim. God has enabled me to forget. Now, this is a very interesting idea, and that is, let's say in the aftermath of the Holocaust, in the aftermath of devastating tragedies, the terrorism that, unfortunately, we've experienced here. On one hand, you never forget. We remember Amalek, the Torah commands us. But, to go on in life, because life has new challenges and different challenges, and the challenges are not the same as they were, to be able to move on with your life, there is a certain amount of forgetting that has to be necessary. Imagine you're Yosef. Now Yosef came from Eretz Yisrael, came from Yaakov Avinu's house. Yosef came from a house of Kedusha. And now Yosef is in a place totally of Tumah. But if all Yosef has is the memory of that past, he's not going to be able to adapt to this life, because this life is not going to be the same as that life. So he actually needed a sense of forgetting. On one hand, Yaakov's face was always in front of him. It's a simultaneous need to remember and to forget at the same time. Because if you don't remember, you don't have the inspiration, you don't have the role model, you don't have the connection to Avodas Hashem that can sustain you. So you have to remember and you have to forget. Because if you don't forget, you're locked into a certain pattern. In fact, I'll tell you the truth, even in the United States, there were many, many eminent rabbanim. If you go back to the early years of the 20th century, you would be very amazed, unless you're aware of this. You went to places like Omaha, Nebraska, and South Dakota, who had people who were Bucky Bashas, Mamish, Gedolim, but nobody ever heard of. And who were their congregants? Their congregants certainly, if they could read Hebrew at all, they certainly couldn't go to a Gemara Shir or anything else. So these were lonely, great, great rabbis. The vast majority of their children and their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, are not religious at all. Because there was no chinuch, they can't even read anything that their grandparents wrote, or even understand it. And in many ways, Some of the rabbis, again, maybe it's not proper for me to fully say it, they didn't have faith that there could ever be any Torah in America. Because their vision was locked into the vision of what Torah was like in Europe. And they saw, whatever we do in America is not going to be like that. So what's the use? The godless of people like Rav Aaron was not only in what they remembered, but in what they forgot. Meaning to say, okay, maybe we're not going to have that, but we'll have something else which can become that eventually. See, it's a subtle point, the idea that to move on, you can't be overly connected to the past, because then you get paralyzed in your inability to create it. And therefore, that is portability of Kedusha. Yes, I'm not in Eretz Yisrael. Yes, I'm not with Yaakov. Yes, I'm not in the atmosphere of Kedusha. I'm in a place of Tuma. But the Mishkan says Kedusha moves with you. So that's the first answer to Yaakov's question. How could Yosef become Yosef when he's in the Tuma environment of Egypt? And this is again Bechlal and Musar for all of us, because once again, it does require that looking at the difficulties of our situation, we can't automatically just connect to a past idyllic world. We got to look at the new challenge that we face. Now, the second answer is the Parsha of Egla Arufa. Now, if you remember, the Torah says by Egla Arufa, we find the corpse. The elders of the city bring the corpse, bring this Egla, this calf. And they confess on the calf, they say, we are not murderers, God, but forgive us. So the Mishnah says, is anybody accusing? These are the Sekanim, these are members of the local Sanhedrin. We're accusing them of murderers and Mimanushach. If they're not murderers, then what are they asking atonement for? Right? They're asking for forgiveness. So the Mishnah in Saita says that somebody gets murdered. Perhaps he was a stranger who came to the town. And maybe we didn't feed him. We didn't take care of him. So he's wandering the streets looking for a home. And as a result, he gets killed by somebody. We as a community are responsible for his death. Because if we would have taken care of him, this would not have happened. Now, the Malbim adds an interesting twist on the Mishnah. The simple meaning of the Mishnah, which says, we must confess our sin if we didn't give him food or lodging. Who is the him in that sentence? The guy that was murdered. That's the simple meaning. That, because if we did not give him food or lodging, and as a result he wandered the street and got killed, we are responsible. The Malbim says something, and again, if you are of a liberal political persuasion, you will like the Malbim's comment. The Malbim's comment is, the him is going on the murderer. Because perhaps a person became a murderer because years before people rejected him. They didn't take care of him. They made him feel like a nothing. So it's not just saying we're responsible for what we didn't do to the victim. We are responsible for what we didn't do to the murderer either. So what is Egla Arufa? Egla Arufa, if Mishkan represents portability of Kedusha, Egla Arufa represents communal responsibility and achrayas. That we can't just look at the world and say, oh, this guy did a bad thing, that's his problem. No. We have to look at how we contributed to it and what we could do to stop it. So now Yosef is giving Yaakov two answers. How does a Jew survive in Golus? Answer, with the recognition of portability of holiness. And number two, the sense of responsibility for your fellow Jew. And that's really a tikkun of sinas chinam. And with that, you can be Yosef at Tzaddik, and you can still be a Moshe b'chol Eretz Mitzrayim. Now, in this connection, I just want to point out, relatively quickly, again, this is deserves a longer treatment, and that is, the beginning of Parshas Vayigash is Yehuda's very long speech, in which he pleads for mercy, and Yosef breaks down and finally reveals himself. And all of them before him want to understand generally, how do you understand Yosef's behavior? Okay, the Shvatim is one thing, but Yosef's behavior, that number one, he knows how much this is going to hurt Yaakov. Yehuda told him ahead of time, before the story, that we have one son that our father said if he's brought down and something happens to him, our father will die. And Yosef puts the gavia, the cup, in Binyamin's bag, and the very night, number one, he demands Binyamin come, and then he frames Binyamin. What is Yosef trying to do here? And why doesn't Yosef reveal himself right away?
So again, this is a long, long sugya in the Torah, that the story of Yosef, from a literary standpoint, is the largest single narrative story in the whole Torah. It's a long
story. But I just want to mention b'kitzer the two main explanations of the Rishonim. There's the Ramban's explanation, and there's the Abarbanel's explanation. The Ramban's explanation is that Yosef has a chiyuv, or he feels he has a chiyuv, to cause the dreams that he had to be fulfilled. Right? Yosef has dreams that 11 stars and the sun and the moon are going to bow down to him. Now the moon literally cannot, you know, the moon is his mother is not alive, but at least Bila, the maid that raised him like a son. At this point, only 10 brothers have bowed down to him. One short. So I have to bring Binyamin down here in order that he shall acknowledge me as a melech. But that's not enough either, because I also have to have the son bow down to me, which is Yaakov Avinu. So the Ramban says, Yosef's kavana, it sounds very bizarre, but this is what the Ramban says. Yosef's kavana was that he figured if he imprisons Binyamin, Yaakov, not knowing that this is Yosef, Yaakov will come down and beg for the freedom of Binyamin. He will bow down to Yaakov, not as a father to a son, which he did later, but as literally to a melech. And the chalomos have been mekuyam, and then Yosef could reveal himself. Again, very, very strange. The Abarbanel asks on the Ram, and what happened was, Yosef couldn't carry it out. Yosef broke down. Yosef aborted the plan before he carried it out to its fruition. But the fruition, the Ramban writes, was that Yaakov would beg Yosef to release Binyamin, and that would have been the kiyum of the 11 stars and the sun and the moon. Abarbanel very much doesn't like Ramban's explanation, because he says the following: a dream is not a divine command. Even if Yosef knew, because he was a Navi, that these are true dreams, not just delusions of grandeur. Let's say Yosef knows these are true dreams. But if Hashem wants you to be a melech, he'll do it. In other words, you don't have a heter to be mavaza your father, to cause pain to your father, because you have a dream you're supposed to be a king. That's up to Hashem. The ends do not justify the means. So because of this, the Abarbanel offers a second explanation. And he says, Yosef's behavior was designed to determine that the brothers have transcended the rivalry and jealousy and hatred that they faced for the children of Rachel. Because the yesod of their jealousy against Yosef, although it was magnified by the dreams, etc., but it was not just the dreams. It was primarily because Yaakov showed a favoritism to the child of Rachel over the child of Leah, and this grated on the brothers. This hurt the brothers. They felt rejected. Yaakov's own behavior is something that needs a lot of study. Why did Yaakov himself behave this way? The Gemara, actually Chazal, have at least one statement in which Yaakov Gufa is criticized for showing that favoritism. But kachave. So as a result of the apparent favoritism that Yaakov has for the children of Rachel, this created jealousy and hatred. Yosef wants to determine that the brothers have gone beyond that rivalry and hatred, that they've done tshuva for what they did. So what he does is, his kavana is, to take the surviving son of, they think is the surviving son of Rachel, imprison that son after being framed for a crime, and to see what the brother's response is. And the fact that Yehuda, who represents the leader of the brothers, is willing to give his life and his freedom for the child of Rachel, shows that they have transcended their jealousy their animosity and their hatred. They have done tshuva, and now I can reveal myself. This is the Abarbanel's approach, that Yosef's whole behavior is to guarantee that his brothers have done tshuva. But one might ask the following question. Might not one ask on the Abarbanel the very same question the Abarbanel asks on the Ramban? And that is that Yosef's business? You have an Aveira, so I'm supposed to, I can lie and I can cheat and I can misrepresent and I can cause my father to suffer because I gotta make you do tshuva? Yeah, the brothers have to do tshuva, but that doesn't allow Yosef carte blanche to do destructive, evil things. First of all, he's hurting Yaakov. Second of all, he's hurting Binyamin. Binyamin was not involved in Mechiras Yosef at all. So there's a lot of innocent people that are getting hurt here, besides the general prohibitions of Sheker and Gnevas Das and everything else. So I would just add to the Abarbanel the following extra piece. And that is, if the chait would simply be a sin committed by 10 individuals against one individual, then the answer would be correct. You know, tshuva is up to them. It's not up to Yosef to engage in all of these bad behaviors. So they'll do tshuva. It's like what we call, what Chazal call, mitzvah haba bi'aveira. You're doing a mitzvah by committing a whole host of sins. But here is the point. Yosef understands that his divine role in this world is to prepare the Jewish people for facing this difficult exile that's going to begin. Yosef teaches us, as we talked about, both how to remain faithful to Hashem at the pinnacle of greatness, and how to remain faithful to Hashem in the most oppressed, lowly state. Like Yosef is teaching us this. Now we know that in the 210 years the Jews lived in Mitzrayim, they actually reached the 49th level of impurity. If they would have stayed even another minute, the amount of time it takes for chametz, for dough to become chametz, you know, the 18 minutes, they would have hit level 50. That's why they were taken out 190 years earlier. They should have been there 400 years. Hashem had to take them out. And yet we know, in spite of the fact that the Jews were in a very lowly state, they had certain merits. And the merits are listed in different ways, but among them are they didn't change their names, they didn't change their language, they didn't change their distinctive clothing, they didn't intermarry according to one view, and they didn't speak Lashon Hara against each other. Now, let me point out, this was not because they were religious in any sense. They were absolutely not religious. They were, except for Shevet Levi, they were Ovdei Avoda Zara. They did not practice Bris Milah. So what's the story? A guy goes to a discotheque in Tel Aviv, and he goes by the name Rafi, so that's some zechus because he keeps his Hebrew name. Why is that a big deal? There's no, Shabbos and Kashrus weren't no gate of them, but like today, no Kashrus, no Shabbos, no Emunah in Hashem. But because he has a Hebrew name and speaks Hebrew, I'm assuming for purposes of analysis that Ivrit and Lashon HaKodesh are the same, then one could discuss that as well. And the answer is, yeah, there is something to that. Because what it means is the following. The merit that enabled the redemption of the Jews in Mitzrayim was not a religious merit. It is true that the purpose of Yetzias Mitzrayim was that we should get the Torah. But the basis of redemption were indicia of what you might call, pejoratively, ethnic identification. I identify myself as a Jew. You are my people. I rejoice in your joys. I suffer in your tragedies. I want to identify with my language and with my clothing and with whom I marry. And because I love and I care about a fellow Jew, I don't want to besmirch their reputation. By the way, they're not speaking Lashon Hara. It doesn't mean they were learning the Chafetz Chaim's laws of Lashon Hara. It primarily means they didn't turn to the authorities to get temporary advantages for them at the expense of others, like the taskmasters didn't report when a Jew didn't finish their work. So what was the zechus? What prevented us from hitting the 50th level was Achdus and Avas Yisrael. So now, look at this from Yosef's perspective. Yosef is the one that is supposed to give us the kochos to survive this long and arduous galus that will virtually destroy us. Yosef will not allow the galus to begin till he determines that the brothers have eradicated the sinas chinam from their hearts. So yeah, if this would have been a private sin committed by 10 people against one person, that would not have been Yosef's business. But Yosef has to have the refuah before the makkah. The galus Mitzrayim cannot begin until the seeds of what will enable our redemption are already in place. And if those seeds are not changing our language, not changing our clothing, which in a general way is Achdus and Avas Yisrael, the brothers have to be purified of their sinas chinam before the galus can begin. Now, I just want to end with a remark of the Chiddushei Harim that is a bit disheartening. The Chiddushei Harim says that had we finished the 400 years in Mitzrayim, that would have rectified, that would have been mesaken our neshamas so much that we wouldn't have needed any other galus. But because we didn't finish the last 190 years, we need thousands of years. Again, the analogy would be, let's say, God forbid, chemotherapy. Sometimes chemotherapy has to be stopped early because it will kill the patient. But by stopping it early, there's something in the system that might get worse and need radical treatment later on. This is exactly the case. We could not have stayed another minute. We would have died. But because we didn't stay, there was a cancer within us. But what that indicates is very pashut. What that indicates is the same way that which enabled the Geulas Mitzrayim was Avas Yisrael. Since every other galus is an expression of that remnant of Mitzrayim that was not completed, then the redemption of all galus only comes in the merit of Avas Yisrael. You know, I remember when I lived in Chicago, I kind of wouldn't remember. Now, on Devon Avenue, there was a kosher-style restaurant called The Bagel. Some of you might recall seeing it. And kosher-style is a trafe restaurant. But I remember years ago walking by, and they had a sign on Shabbos that we serve cholent on Shabbos. So you think about a sign like that, and you see how ridiculous it is on so many levels. Number one, the food is trafe. Number two, you have to pay money. You know, it's cooked on Shabbos. You know, you could enumerate a million prohibitions. And what is the point of eating? I mean, the whole eating of cholent is a zehiras of Klal Yisrael, not to cook on Shabbos. So you can laugh at that, and you can say, "What a meaningless thing!" But things are not as meaningless as you might suspect, because what is being said here? Somebody says, "You know, Shabbos is a special day. I want to do something. I want to do something. I'm going to have treif cholent in a treif restaurant." Is it the end of being a Jew? Is it the end purpose? No, of course it's not. The end purpose of being a Jew is Kabbalas Mitzvos, but it is the beginning, and in fact, it was the beginning that enabled our nation to be redeemed from Mitzrayim. So as we approach Asara B'Teves, these are some thoughts that we should have in mind. I hope everyone should have a good fast. Amir Tzashem, there will not be a fast this year, because we hope Gula Shlema, but if not, we should be at least be a meaningful fast.